And I'm Renee Paul.
I'm here today with Dr. John Lorner, who Hello. I'm going to let introduce himself because he has done so many things.
Well, I've been a GP for 30 years. That's my main profession, although I'm retired clinically now. While I was a GP, I also trained as a family therapist, and I combined clinical family therapy with being a GP. And I became very interested in how to apply therapeutic skills in general practice, but equally how to help people who worked as therapists or mental health professionals work in primary care and understand primary care. And that's really where I've spent most of my profession, although now I work as an educator right across primary and secondary care and social care as well. So I describe myself now as a full-time educator.
I'm just intrigued. What made you train as a family therapist?
I had had a GP trainer who was one of the very first GPs in the country to train as a family therapist.
Right.
And he really inspired and enthused me from the very beginning. And once I started in general practice, I did exactly what he had done, which was sometimes when I was working with a family and I got stuck with them, with a child with a behavioural problem or whatever, I would actually go along with them to the Tavistock Clinic and take them to see a family therapist there.
Yes.
And through that experience, I decided it would be really useful to train and actually have a dual role, really, and to be able to do both.
So it must have really changed the way you viewed general practice or families or systems?
Yes, it influenced me, I guess, you could say in two ways or under two headlines. One is an understanding of systems and how everybody's experiences are so closely linked to their experiences as children, to their experiences within their current family, and obviously to wider systems and networks such as their culture and society and so forth. And the other thing was really the importance of narratives. At the time I was training as a family therapist, the whole field was moving from, in a way, quite a mechanistic understanding of how systems worked and using analogies with biological systems and physical systems towards an understanding of reality as something that's created by people's stories, by the way they tell their stories. One person will never tell the same story in the same way to two different people, and that actually as you tell the stories, you're reconstructing them, so the next time it will be different. It helped me to understand, for example, that when patients say something at the beginning of a consultation and give a completely different description later in the consultation, actually that's a normal human thing to do. They're not confused. I used to get irritated, like every GP, why can't they make up their minds? Or they come back next week and you say, how's the pain? And they say, what pain? And you think, oh, for goodness sake, you spent the whole consultation talking about pain. And actually we don't notice how our stories evolve through dialogue. And so the whole of general practice became, to me, a much more kind of contextualized and evolving conversation rather than just something about problem solving and getting them out of the room with a prescription.
As quick as possible sometimes.
Absolutely, yes.
You gave lots of examples of this in your book about how we help patients co-construct their stories.
Yes.
Are there any examples that you can give to some of the doctors listening so they can really kind of crystallizes in their minds?
Well, let me start with a general description of that process, and then I'll see if I can think of some particular examples. Patients come to us pretty much always with what we conceptualize as a problem.
Yes.
But the problem is also pretty much always embedded in a story. And what we generally do is to focus on the problem and not to listen to the story, except for the sake of politeness and except because we know it's the right thing to do. But we don't actually think they need to go away both with a solution to their problem, but also with some kind of account that makes sense to them. In other words, with a new story, they need to be able to go home and say, the doctor explained that what was wrong with me was this, and to a certain extent I understand it, and to a certain extent I think I can explain to you, and he or she prescribed these pills and I think I understand why. So they need some kind of coherent, one might almost say, an aesthetic account of what's happened, of where they are now,
mm-hmm.
as well as solving a problem. What they don't want to go home with is just with the problem solved. So they say, well, the doctor explained I had something, but I don't remember the name and I didn't really understand. And he told me to take these pills, but I'm not going to
mm-hmm.
because I didn't really understand why. So that's why we need both a problem solution and a narrative resolution. So that's the process that I've been very taken up with understanding and teaching really over the last, I would say, 25 years of my career. Patients say things during consultations like, that's a really good question. We're all familiar with that. Or they say, you know what? I didn't really understand what I thought until I heard myself say it. Now, we're familiar with all those processes, but we don't identify those as actual narrative resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
A fairly dramatic example, a sort of epiphany that somebody might have is that, you know, they come in with panic attacks and you talk to them about the panic attacks and, you know, suddenly they remember something from their family of origin. One particular woman I remember who got panic attacks when her daughter was exactly the age that she had been when her own mother died.
Yeah.
Yeah. She literally hadn't made that connection. Yeah. Now, that's very dramatic. That might happen once a year, once every 2 years. But it illustrates the kind of connections that people make where they'll go away and then think about something and process it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it happens in a sort of microscopic way in every good consultation, that there's an evolution of understanding as well as thinking, well, the doctor's fixed it for me.
Absolutely. And I can now think back at my own consultations
Yes.
and when I am doing that and when I'm not doing that. And
Yes.
perhaps that's when consultations don't work. Now, I'm thinking in terms of medical education, because
Yes.
we are teaching students how to take histories, and
Yes.
now we're teaching them to take illness scripts. But are we teaching them to listen to people's stories? Do you think we're beginning to do that?
I have to start with a confession that I've spent most of my career as an educator working with established practitioners.
Mm.
In other words, I work mainly with people who have hit mid-career
mm-hmm.
and feel there's something missing.
Mm.
So they come voluntarily along to learn about what we call narrative medicine, narrative
mm-hmm.
practice. And they know that they're not getting the fulfillment that they want, or they know that they're reaching levels of complexity that none of their prior training equipped them to work with. For that reason, among others, I've not focused my own work on medical students or those who teach medical students. I've also identified, I guess, a resistance in myself because I kind of think that, you know, they're so busy with learning the stuff.
Mm.
They're so busy with learning the facts. They're so anxious about not getting it wrong, not
mm.
making mistakes, that it could be quite hard for them to take on board what is essentially quite a subversive view of the process of medicine and the medical consultation. Now, recently I've been working more with medical students and with foundation doctors and so on, and with the people who teach them. And I think it is possible to help them to understand the need to integrate the two. One of the exercises I use is to invite them to recall the kind of conversation they have when they see their hairdressers or their barbers.
Mm-hmm.
And how do those people engage with them? How do they manage to keep the ball in the air? How do they manage to create the kind of relationship that the client actually wants to come back? Because hairdressers and barbers and other people who work in that way actually depend on people feeling good about them, wanting to return. And it's interesting, when you help students or young doctors move into that mode, they come up very readily with ideas about, well, the kind of things my hairdresser barber talked to me
okay,
about
yeah.
to engage.
Yeah.
They can do it. They can role play that
yeah.
kind of approach. And then the challenge, of course, is to help them understand, how do you do both? How can you listen to the story, engage with the story, help people to unravel more of their story, but also solve their problems for them? And there are ways that they can find of doing it, particularly when they understand the more story you get, the more surprising nuggets of scientific fact
mm-hmm.
you are likely to discover. Oh, that's reminded me, my uncle had fits, which the person person wouldn't have thought of unless you had a so-called social chat about their family. You know, the other way round, that they're talking about sort of, you know, the stuff you really need to know. You're asking them about, you know, blood and pain and when did it start and where does it go and all this stuff that, you know, we're taught of as clerking. But while they're doing that, something will emerge that has a narrative element to it and you follow that. So you learn it's actually not hard to do at the same time. And of course, the more experience you have, the more you can have a very natural conversation, but think, you know what, at some point, I must ask about vision.
Mm.
If it doesn't come up naturally, I'm going to have to say, look, I know this isn't what you're talking about at the moment, but I do need to ask, have you had any change in your eyesight?
Yes.
Because that's your stuff.
Yes.
Because otherwise, they say, you know, I think my feet are getting bigger, and you think, oh my goodness, whatever, acromegaly or whatever, yes. I'm making this up. And you have to ask the unrelated question. They don't know why. So you can either wait for it or you can signpost that you're now having to move from a narrative to what we call a normative mode.
Yes, which we do teach the students to do, don't
yes,
we?
Very I hope much. So. Yes.
So signposting, I think they're quite familiar with. I think we were just talking about how often I think our tutors will have students sitting in with them, and I do. And it just sounds like we're chatting to
yes.
our patients. And the students
yes.
just think, why is this GP just chatting all
yes.
day about how to really almost signpost to the students why you're doing that and what you're achieving.
I have a memory myself as a medical student of going to see a GP who had a fantastic reputation as being a wonderful listener, very caring doctor. And I literally can remember thinking, how on earth does this man get paid for chatting all day, for gossiping? And I think we could do more to unpack that
yes.
with our students and with our trainees and say, why do you think I went off on that tangent at that stage? Why do you think I asked about her dog? And help them to understand you may have done it for all sorts of reasons, but most likely to calibrate the relationship, to calibrate the level of trust, sensing the level of anxiety in the room, working with that, because you knew that unless you worked with that, the person would clam up.
Yes.
And literally their memory and their thinking would be affected, so that unless you created that trust in that way, you couldn't actually get the information you wanted from a purely medical point of view.
Yeah, no,
so
absolutely.
Those processes that I think we need to attune our medical students to.
My husband's a surgeon,
okay.
and he does a lot of procedures under local
yes.
anaesthetic. So he does basically hairdressers' chats.
Yes.
For often half an hour at
yes.
a time, to really put people at ease.
Wonderful.
And the students often ask, why are you doing this?
Yes.
And I get completely why he's doing that. But I think it's
yes.
a skill that he's fine-tuned.
Yes.
So maybe this is a skill we could teach.
I can remember a conversation that our son had when he needed an operation when he was quite young, 7 or 8, and the anaesthetist, I think, was a paediatric anaesthetist, was one of the most skillful conversationalists with
okay.
children I've
yes.
ever come across. So that would have been a wonderful teaching video
yeah.
as well.
But you still remember that.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And he remembers it too. There's a lot more I could say about that, but essentially I think we need to teach conversational skills.
Yes.
But one of my constant mottos is you can have a good conversation without necessarily solving somebody's problem,
mm-hmm.
but you can almost never solve anyone's problem without having a good conversation.
Okay, good take-home points.
I think so. So if you go into every encounter with the resolution, if nothing else, I'm going to have a good quality conversation with this person, there's a reasonable chance you'll solve their problem.
A line that you wrote that's really stayed with me was that we are a scene in people's film of their lives, or am
yes.
I quoting you correctly?
It's pretty much what I say, which is that we should always remember that what we're seeing in a consultation is a snapshot
mm-hmm.
in an enormously long and highly populated video.
Yes.
That the conversation that we're having with them in our 10 minutes or whatever time it is, we know from research it's likely to be something like, on average, the 8th conversation they've had with somebody about that experience. They've
yeah.
already talked to several members of their family,
yeah.
their best friend, their neighbour, the pharmacist, etc.
Yeah.
So it's helpful to orient ourselves in where are we in that process.
Yes.
which you can ask, you know, who else have you talked to about this? What's their view been? Mm-hmm. And to remember it's also going to continue with a large population of other people. They're going to go away and they're going to report favourably or unfavourably the encounter they've had with you. And that gives us a kind of humility in the face of what we often assume, which is, this is it. We fix something for them.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's a conversational episode in an enormously long soap opera, to change the metaphor.
For longer than a film.
Yes.
So again, you think it's about signposting this to our students, explaining a bit more how long you've known the person for, and you know their family, and you know more characters in the soap opera.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have a past, your relationship with them has a future, and this is a conversation that is an attempt to progress some aspect of their experience, possibly not the most important aspect of their experience, but the one that they thought it was fitting to bring to you, but part of an enormous dance of other interactions and other conversations that you're working with.
No, that's really helpful, I think, for our tutors to think about. So if our tutors want to read more about your work, John, where can they do that?
Well, I published the latest edition of my book last year. It's called Narrative-Based Practice in Health and Social Care, published by Routledge. We also have a website. When I say we, over the years, I've helped to develop this method with an increasing number of other trainers. We now have 20 or 30 trainers specifically of this method. We have a website called conversationsinvitingchange.com. And if you look there, you'll not only see a whole range of materials, there's a podcast, there's a video, there's lots of stuff to read, articles, handouts and so on, all freely available. And it also gives details of courses that we run, and courses are commissioned by hospital trusts, by CCGs, by training hubs, by all sorts of organisations.
Fantastic. And John is about to do a workshop for some of our tutors today. So even if you couldn't make his latest one, I'm sure he will come back and do another one.
I'd be very happy to.